unexpected. He's going to either go unexpectedly high or he's going to go in the second, third round. There's not going to be a middle ground. Like, second half of the first round to me is not where he's going to get picked.
That's John Wilner talking about one of the Pac-12 quarterbacks in the NFL draft. Who's he talking about? Find out. I'm John Canzano. This is an all-new episode of Canzano and Wilner, the podcast.
What's better than one John?
Here's Johnny.
Nobody really knows. That's why we put two of them together. This is Canzano and Wilner,
a.k.a. John and John.
There are no shortage of topics this week. We're going to talk about Oregon State and Washington State's pursuit of a media rights deal. They've got 13 football games that they need to sell. Do they have a buyer? I think they do, but you'll hear Scott Barnes talk about it and John Wilner give his analysis of it. Also, Oregon State non-conference scheduling, are they scheduling with some strategy? Meaning, are they trying to get into the Big 12 by scheduling football games against Big 12 opponents? Also, we'll talk about John Wilner's work and reporting, great reporting on the finances of the Pac-12 schools and athletic departments in general. And we'll touch on the Pac-12 quarterbacks, Michael Penix Jr., Bo Nix, Caleb Williams. Where will they go in the draft? I'm John Canzano. You can read me at johncanzano.com. Get a free subscription or a paid subscription. What works for you works for me. John Wilner, Bay Area News Group. You can find him at pac12hotline.com. Wilner, where do we start today? Where should we start this discussion?
I'm always in favor of starting with the news, and you've got some news.
All right, let's start with the news. First, you know, obviously Oregon State, Washington State have 13 home football games this year that they are going to have to package into a media rights deal. I believe that deal is with the CW. Scott Barnes, on my radio show yesterday, talked about that.
Can you give us an update on where you are with football and the media rights deal and TV? I know these things are ongoing and evolving, but are you close to a deal? Or are you, where are you if this is a baseball game? What inning are we in?
I appreciate that. You know, before I answer that, let me just say, as I think about, John, this last 9 months, and I think about sort of the clandestine process that we've had to undergo, and whether it's media rights, grantor rights, conference alignment, things that, you know, we can't talk about because it's not only not helpful to talk publicly, it's harmful in a lot of ways. So I do want to send a message out to Beaver Nation, letting them know I hear you and I'm frustrated with it too. But I think if you look at the 9 months, as we get information we absolutely share it and we'll continue to do that. Let me answer your question in terms of innings. This one went extra innings,
okay.
And we're in the final inning, and we're about ready to win the extra inning ball game here.
You know, it's always a balance of revenue and exposure, but you had some wins in the courtroom and in negotiations. Did it become more important, or has it been more important to seek exposure, or what's that balance for you?
Yeah, very much so, John, exposure. And as you think about the pie that is media rights and how that's divided up, we leaned in Washington State and Oregon State very heavily on making sure we were in the most homes we could be in, right? The biggest reach we could make in that regard. So exposure was priority one in that regard, for sure.
John Wilner, your rapid reaction to Scott Barnes, the Oregon State AD.
Well, they certainly need some clarity soon, right? So they can start pinning down their schedule, their kickoff times, and get that out to their fans. So I would have to think by, what, the end of this month, early May? But generally speaking, my view is, if they need to, those two schools should pay a broadcast network to show their games. The money piece doesn't matter at all for those 13 football games, whether they're getting $1 million a game or $50 a game. They need to be seen so they're not forgotten.
How do you feel? Because I have sources telling me that it's the CW, and that's a over-the-air 99.5 people in America can get it. I guess it would keep the Pac-12 network production facility busy because the CW doesn't have in-house production.
So there's maybe a bonus there, and maybe they become a partner on the CW, on LIV Golf, or whatever else they're producing. But how do you feel about the CW? How will that be greeted?
Not knowing what their options were, I would say CW's good. That's a good option, right? You know, assuming ESPN wasn't offering them premium broadcast windows because there aren't any available on ESPN, I think it's good. The ACC, the thing is, there'll be some synergy with the ACC because the CW's got a package of ACC football. That works. That's good for the schools. They need a place where they can be seen and where there's some flexibility on the kickoff times, right? And CW isn't packed with games from morning till night, so that'll give them the chance to play. I think they need to play a lot of afternoon games, not only for their fans to get in the stadium, but they need to play afternoon games so that those highlights can then be shown on the studio shows that Fox and ESPN have for the rest of the day, the evening, and late at night, because those highlights are an important, you know, exposure opportunity, almost as important as the games themselves in their three-hour windows. The earlier you're playing, the more chance you're on the highlight shows, the more chance you're talked about by studio analysts, and that keeps you relevant.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's something that people don't often think about. You know, you talk about exposure and revenue, but you're right. With those kickoff times, how many times do we see the highlights of the games that start early in the Pacific time zone? We're watching these East Coast games that will kick off 9 or 10 a.m. our time, and we see those highlights all day long. And at halftime of all of the traditional Pac-12 games, it was all these highlights that were from other parts of the country.
And that's what's wrong with – that's one of the problems with the 7:30 Pac-12 kickoffs, right, is those games have – almost no shelf life once they end. They end at 11. ESPN and Fox aren't showing college football late Saturday night on studio shows. And then once you get up on Saturday morning, you've got Sunday morning, you've got the NFL. So they've got to kick off early.
Scott Barnes also talked about the scheduling announcement that Oregon State made this week. They have scheduled Kansas State and Houston in home-and-home series moving forward. This raised some eyebrows. Is it strategy? Is it coincidence? Is this a commitment? Like, is Oregon State lobbying the Big 12 by scheduling Big 12 opponents? Here's what Barnes said on that front.
There's a couple things there, right? One, we're scheduling in advance. We've got to build our schedule for 25. But as we think about that, absolutely any connection that we can have consistent connection, whether it be in the room or in scheduling or other areas with Power 5 conferences, in particular the Big 12 and the ACC, we want to do that. We want to continue to foster relationships there, and that certainly is part of the strategy.
You know, is it a deviation where, you know, or is it just a continuation? Because you already were playing Oklahoma State, you know, in prior years, but it just looked apparent that, you know, hey, that's a peer group that you want to be associated with.
It's more intentional, much more intentional than it ever has been.
Well, I mean, certainly, I think there's some value playing Houston just generally for recruiting standpoint, you know, an exposure in Texas where Oregon State has recruited a lot. I think that's smart. They're hoping to get into the Big 12 or the ACC at some point in the next few years. Whether that's a realistic outcome, I don't know. But I think it's much more more prudent to be scheduling games against those schools than it would be to try to get Wisconsin or Indiana or Rutgers. You know, that it just makes a lot more sense.
Yeah,
and the more they can play the, you know, I don't know what Cal and Stanford schedules, you know, for the rest of the decade are, but if they can get Cal and Stanford on their schedules, they should.
Yeah, 100%. I think they would be interested in that too, just from a travel standpoint. The other thing is, you know, I look at the Big 12 schools, and I was thinking about this from more like an Arizona State perspective that more than anything, but now that Barnes says that, you know, those Big 12 schools look more like Washington State and Oregon State. They are peers in appearance, in fan base, in land grant schools, and they just look more like. And I was looking at Arizona State specifically as I was talking a little with Kenny Dillingham this week, that,
You know, Arizona State, in the last 20 times they've played Oregon and USC, they are 5-15 in their last 20 against those two opponents. Those are losses on the schedule. And so Arizona State fans, every year, schedule comes out, they look at Oregon, they look at USC, and then more recently they looked at Washington and they've gone, okay, those are losses. I'm looking at Arizona State's schedule this year, and they're not going to go undefeated. They're coming off a 3-9 season, but you know, you don't see obvious losses on their schedule. It's just, this is a better peer group for Arizona State, Arizona. I think Utah's going to dominate. I think Colorado's going to have good trajectory, better than they would have in the Pac-12. And I think Oregon State, Washington State would fit in that group.
The Big 12 is flat. I look at it that way. There is very little difference between the top football program and the bottom football program compared to the difference between the top and bottom in the Big 10 and the SEC. Those conferences are vertical in their football hierarchy. Big 12 is much flatter. ACC, closer to the Big 10 SEC because you got Florida State and Clemson sitting there. So, you know, from a competitive standpoint, the Big 12's calling card is that it's going to be super competitive. And it could be the most entertaining conference. And certainly, if you're one of the corner schools, you have a much better chance of competing on a year-to-year basis in the Big 12 than you would, you know, in the Big 10 or the SEC.
Let's pivot to some of the stuff you've been working on this week, the finances. You were looking at athletic departments who are being subsidized by the universities and, you know, an interesting picture formed amid your reporting.
Yeah, so the background is that each winter, and I don't that it's sometime in January, the schools are all required to report their statements of revenue and expenses to the NCAA for the previous fiscal year. So this January, everybody reported their budgets for the fiscal year that ended last summer. And I began collecting all of them. Some of them are easily you can find them easy on the school's website. Some of them you have to make public records requests for. You know, it took me a while and there was a lot going on. So I finally this month kind of dove into what the budgets look like for the Pac-12 schools. And I've got numbers for all of them except for USC, which is private. Stanford actually made its annual report public on the internet. So the big takeaway is these schools, with one exception, Oregon, these schools are all heavily reliant upon support from Central Campus to make their budgets work. A lot of them are taking 10, 20, 30 millions in campus support, and that support comes in two ways. One, it is student fees that get allocated for athletics, and the other is direct transfers from campus to athletics. And you're getting $10, $20, $30 million, and that gets booked as revenue according to the NCAA's reporting procedures. So, you know, school X shows they got $100 million in revenue, but $20 million of that could be internal from Central Campus. So what I tried to do was look at the state of play without that help from Central Campus. How are these schools doing? How are the athletic departments doing if you remove the revenue that is transfers from Central Campus and student fees? And how healthy is everybody? And the answer is not so healthy. There's about $150 million, and this is, again, in fiscal 23, $150 million in campus support was funneled to the athletic departments, right? Enabling them to balance their books, come close. If you remove that money, that help from campus, then the 11 schools, including Stanford, the 11 schools lost almost $300 million. It's a huge amount. And that includes a loan that Arizona took from campus for $31 million. It's a huge amount. So I ask you, You think that's a problem? Is it a problem that schools are giving $10, $20, $30 million to athletics to help athletics balance the books?
It's a complete problem. And Oregon had this issue maybe two decades ago where they were getting blowback from student body, professors on campus, donors on the academic side who were saying, we're tired of subsidizing athletics. And so, you know, you can slide things around on your balance sheet to make it look like you're more self-sufficient. But Oregon made a real effort to try to become self-sufficient. And of course, they had inherent advantages with Phil Knight and Nike involved. And so they were able to do that better than most. But I think there's a big problem that it's just not sustainable. And I think you're looking at higher education considering private equity. I've talked to some private equity firms who are kicking the tires on higher ed to say, like, should this be a for-profit thing? If you would never run a business this way, right? You would never run a business that would be bleeding $20 or $30 million in one arm of the entity that, you know, you just go, okay, we're going to write that off as a loss. You just never would do that. And so I don't think it's sustainable. And I think we're watching, like, Oregon State went for the first time to the state legislature this last session. They asked for $10 million for athletic scholarships. Unprecedented. And they got some empathy from the state legislature in part because I think if they didn't get that money, I think the lawmakers knew that the money was going to come from the university side. And so, you know, it was apples to oranges, and they said, okay, we're going to help keep you afloat. They gave them $10 million for this next year. And I think Washington State is going to make the same ask in the state of Washington. And so I think that everybody knows it's not sustainable. Everybody's wondering what happens when you make athletes employees. It looks like it would absolutely kill the Olympic sports and the non-revenue generating sports, because why have them if they're going to cost you that much? And so I think there is a systemic issue here. And yeah, I think the more people know, I think, Wilner, a lot of this has been fuzzed up, so good on you for doing the reporting on it. But the more people know about where that money's going, the more uncomfortable they're going to be with it. And they're going to look at the money being paid to athletes through NIL, even though it's not connected. They're going to look at the coaching salaries. They're going to look at all the expenses that athletics takes on. And I think there's going to be a lot of people who are uncomfortable with that subsidization model.
The business piece is really interesting, right? Because I agree that nobody would run a business that way. But at the same time, the schools are forced to run businesses that you wouldn't find anywhere else. Because, you know, let's say a typical Pac-12 school or SEC, Big Ten, any of them, you got two profitable subsidiaries, football and men's basketball, and all your other 16, 18, 20 sports are losing money. No business would have two profitable entities and 18 money-losing entities. They'd cut those money-losing entities, right? But you can't do that in major college athletics. So that the entire model is screwed up in many ways. And that's forcing a series of awkward, you know, business relationships that these schools have got to have. The reason they're chasing all the TV money from ESPN and Fox is they've got to support athletic departments that have 16, 18 subsidiaries that aren't profitable. So it's just a really difficult model for these schools to sustain. And I agree with you there. I do wonder, though, given the importance of football for the entire university, right? And we see that all the time. We saw what Colorado's fast start last season and what that did for the university, what Oregon's success has done. There's tons of examples. So could you look at it like that, say, let's say Washington, right? Washington got $10.3 million from campus last year, right? If that's helping their athletic department and their football team, it's kind of a marketing expense in some ways, right? And football is a huge marketing tool for these schools. So I think that there's probably a fine line that they need to walk between not subsidizing bad decisions, bad business decisions, but also providing the football teams with the resources they need to succeed, because there's no more visible entity for your university than the football team.
Along those lines, and maybe this dovetails with it nicely, you know, we saw Colorado last year with the 4-0 start, all the attention. Coach Prime's start was celebrated as, you know, what a forward-thinking, great hire by Rick George. Season ticket sales, spring game, televised nationally. Colorado having some issues in the transfer portal now. And Rick George, the athletic director, with an interesting tweet. The portal's been brutal. He tweets, quote, "Thank the AGs that filed the temporary restraining order," end quote. For people who don't know, transfers now, it's not just unrestricted free agency. It's unrestricted, unlimited free agency. You can transfer as many times as you want. You just can't compete in the same season for two different programs, which is should go without saying. But Wilner, what do you make of Rick George throwing some shade?
I mean, I'm sure that generated a lot of response on social media, right? I mean, there's certainly some irony there. They brought in, what, 60, 65 transfers last year to rebuild their program under Sanders, and for them to get frustrated with the transfer situation, it's a little bit rich. Now, he's talking about the fact that the rules have been changed so you can now, like you said, transfer multiple times, right? That was not in place last year. But generally speaking, Colorado, I don't have a ton of sympathy for Colorado losing guys to the portal, given the way their football program worked the system last year. I didn't have a problem with the way they worked the system last year. I don't have a problem with the fact that they're now on the other side of it. It's all part of the Dion experience, I think. And that experience is unlike anything we've seen in college football. But I'm sure some fans out there think that it was very, very rich irony for Rick George to be frustrated with the transfer portal. What did you think?
I'm fascinated to see what happens next, because, you know, he had Shiloh on Instagram posting, "Hey, if you're in the portal or you're a defensive transfer, DM me. If you're an offensive-minded transfer, DM Shador." He's got his kids recruiting on social media, and I can't decide if that looks desperate or if it's genius. Like, it's one or the other. There's no
in
between.
It's just part of the Dion experience. We got to just sit back and enjoy it. That's my view.
I also think he loses the 2023 class number one defensive back, jumps in the portal. And to me, that was interesting, because if anybody should want to be on that team playing for Coach Prime, it's that kid. And then you see, you know, the coordinators, obviously, Sean Lewis going to San Diego State, Brian Kelly going, 1 year's enough for me. What do you make of sort of the turnover there? And is it sustainable for Dion, or is this just until Shador and Shiloh run out of eligibility, he's gone too?
Well, I think he's going to be gone when he's got a good opportunity. I don't believe that they have – I think this is the last year that they can basically bring in an unlimited number of transfers, right? They have – there's a two-year I hope I don't regret this, but I'm pretty sure that the NCAA implemented basically a two-year window where there's no cap on the amount of incoming players you can take if there's been a coaching change. So I think this is it. And next year they're going to have to work under more restrictions. But again, this is just Dion. Everything is different about him as a coach and the program he's running. And if he's going to use his kids, he's going to use his kids. It's just one more part of the experience. I don't think they're going to be competing for a Big 12 title. I think they've still got too many holes on their roster. But it will be whatever happens, it's going to be fun to watch.
Yeah, and I think they proved last year in the early part of the year, you know, they had that big game with TCU. They proved they can play with some of those Big 12 teams. I don't think they're going to run into an Oregon or a USC or even, you know, some of the Pac-12 teams that you would automatically go, that's a loss, you know. So I think they'll have better footing, but I agree with you. I think they'll be at best in the middle tier of the Big 12 next year, at best.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot was made about the TCU and Nebraska wins. Those teams were bad.
Yeah.
They weren't any good. So it was certainly, you know, overblown, and that was easy to see coming, but it was also very entertaining. The interesting piece to me on this whole transfer portal thing is I think the next step, and it may take a couple years, I think the NCAA is going to get forced to remove the four-year eligibility clock. To me, that is like the next hurdle for all the attorneys out there that are trying to dismantle the NCAA. I think we're going to get to the point later in the decade where you can play for 5 or 6 years, or maybe it's unlimited, right? I mean, if the average student takes more than 4 years to graduate, why should the NCAA limit your eligibility clock to 4 years?
Are you telling me LeBron's going to enroll at
USC? I think once you turn pro, you can't come back. But I could see guys, you know, unlimited transfers plus removal of eligibility clock plus immediate eligibility, you could end up seeing guys that play for six schools in 6 years. I do not think that that is an unreasonable end game here, given the way the NCAA is getting bludgeoned in court.
Yeah, and the coaches.
Is that wrong? Is that wrong to play for six teams in 6 years? I mean, if the coaches are willing to take you, I wouldn't blame the athletes for doing it.
I wouldn't be comfortable with it myself, and I think it does remove some of the things that college gives you. Like, there's a resilience that you learn in college. You're dealing with, you know, not everything's going your way, and you got to work through it. You did that. I did that. A lot of college kids had to work through things that didn't go their way. The problem is, I think this generation of athletes that we're watching in college right now, they came up in a club system or an AAU system where if a coach told them something they didn't want to hear, they just moved to another club. They transferred. They jumped clubs. And so, you know, I know that it wasn't that long ago I started seeing high school basketball recruits who had played at three or four schools. And I went, oh, my gosh, this is terrible. This is awful. Like, you know, and now we're going – now we're seeing kids that are going to do that in college, and it should come as no surprise to us because they've been doing this. This is what they've been doing.
Yeah, no, I agree that they're taking the easy way out in a lot of cases, but there shouldn't be rules that restrict them from doing that. Like, that should be their own decision. If I'm going to take the path of least resistance, I'm going to take the path of least resistance. You can't tell me not to. So I just think it'll be real interesting to see where this goes. And would a world in which guys are going six schools in 6 years, five schools in 6 years, four schools in 5 years, whatever it is that going to impact the fans' desire to follow their teams, buy tickets, watch games? I don't think it will. I think that college sports is, in a way, you know, because it's your alma mater, you're going to root for that team no matter who's playing quarterback, no matter who's doing what. And in a way, that kind of insulates college sports from the impact of player movement.
I think there are some people turned off, and I'm hearing it particularly from Oregon State and Washington State fans who are just, you know, they've had gut punch after gut punch. But let's see what happens. And I'm hesitant, though, Wilner, to... You know, we saw ratings for the national championship game, college football playoff championship game. We saw ratings in the NCAA tournament all held up as, hey, see, look, everybody's tuning in. This is all healthy. I need a bigger sample size. I need to see what happens in the regular season with season ticket sales not at Oregon, right? Oregon's up 10,000 tickets because the fans are excited about seeing Big Ten teams come. But I want to see season ticket sales, you know, at rank-and-file schools, you know, 3 or 4 seasons from now, what's the trend going to be? Because it was already testing people. And maybe the new matchups that we're seeing in the Big 12, the ACC, SEC, Big 10, maybe that's going to bring infuse some joy and some interest. But I do think people are being tested right now. And your fandom is being tested by this whole ecosystem.
The other thing, too, is, though, I think the expanded playoff is going to do wonders for interest because more teams are going to be involved in the postseason race in October and November, and that could offset, you know, from an audience standpoint, that could offset folks who are turned off by the state of affairs. So we'll see. It'll be really interesting to see how it goes next couple years.
Two different things. I think tournaments and championship games bring in
a whole nother audience that's just interested in seeing the championship game and the tournament. And I think there's a segment of diehard fans who are there all the time. And I wonder what happens to that sort of band of sports fans. We'll have to track that. Pivoting a little bit, we got the NFL draft coming up. Can we talk a little bit about the draft and maybe just the Pac-12 QBs?
Well, we know who's going number one, right?
And he's the no-brainer in my mind. Caleb Williams, number one, that's the guy you'd have to pick. You agree with that? Do you have any concerns with Caleb Williams being the no-brainer number one pick?
I certainly have a few concerns about him as a pro, but I think it's a lock that he's number one. I don't even think the Bears are bringing anybody else in. I think they are completely sold on Caleb Williams. And, you know, it's hard to blame him. Who do you think, all right, you got to bet a nickel, who's the second Pac-12 quarterback selected?
Michael Penix Jr.
You think he goes ahead of Nix?
I do. I think Penix has done enough. And, you know, the fact that he ran a great 40 time, he looks like a better athlete than the scouts were giving him credit for. He's got the arm. He can throw the deep ball. All this sand. It's the easy stuff that they can coach. It's the, you know, the intermediate stuff, the read. They can coach some of this stuff. He has everything you can't coach. And he's got it in buckets. And so I think somebody's going to take Michael Penix in the first round. And Bo Nix could go in the first round, although he's not going to the draft. Probably going to spend it with his family. The Broncos. The problem with the Broncos, everyone looks at him and says, gosh, they would be a great fit. I covered Drew Brees when he was in college at Purdue as a beat reporter. Bo Nix reminds me a little bit of Drew Brees. You know, I think they're both very mature. They both had questions about their arm strength in college. They both were very accurate. They're both super smart. You know, they're students. I could see Sean Payton falling in love with Bo Nix. Problem is, Denver has the number 12 pick in the first round, and they don't have a second round pick. And Bo Nix, I think you can get him later than number 12. I think you can get him at the end of the first round or early in the second round.
To me, the Penix situation seems like it's going to be unexpected. He's going to either go unexpectedly high or he's going to go in the second, third round. There's not going to be a middle ground. Like, second half of the first round to me is not where he's going to get picked. Either he goes top 10, top 12, or he falls into the second round. I just don't know. You know, the NFL believes that the greatest predictor of injuries is injuries, right? And they're going to look and they see he's got surgically multiple season-ending surgeries, right? When he was in Indiana. And do you risk that investment in a quarterback who has shown he is injury-prone? I don't know. I think all things being equal, he should go number two. To me, besides Caleb Williams, he is the best quarterback prospect in the draft. I would take him number two. And I think there's a chance he's going to have a phenomenal career.
Yeah.
But I don't know with the injuries. I don't know.
He's underrated. I think, you know, we've watched all these projections about J.J. McCarthy. I saw enough of him this season. And we've seen Jaden Daniels, tremendous upside, but there are some holes in his game. And so I just think Michael Penix Jr. reminds me of a lot of guys that we have seen have great careers. And I think he's going to go in the first round. And I think he goes in front of Nix. I think Nix, if I'm Denver, I try to move back if I really want him. I'd move back. They need assets. They gave up way too much in that Russell Wilson trade, including their second-round pick. Maybe they get it back by moving back and pick Bo Nix at the end of the first round, in early in the second round. I think that's where you can get him. But Drake May, J.J. McCarthy, Jaden Daniels, those guys are for someone else. I think, you know, the narrative for me was that the Pac-12 had the best quarterbacking this year, and I believe I picked Caleb Williams. I gave him my Heisman vote 2 years ago. I gave Penix my Heisman vote this year. I had Daniels on my ballot, but I had him second. I had him behind Caleb Williams. And so it's Caleb Williams, Michael Penix. Then I think there's a drop-off. And Drake May will go. But I think Nix goes late in the first, early in the second. Won't be surprised to see him, like, right around pick 35 overall in the draft. I think he's got that kind of upside, and he's so experienced. He's one of the few guys as a rookie that I think you would feel okay playing that guy.
It's the quarterback drafting process is so interesting to me because ultimately it is unknowable. You got these NFL teams that pour all this time, all these resources into evaluating these guys. They've got all their scouts and their GMs, player personnel folks. Everybody is scrutinizing these quarterbacks, and yet they still get it wrong more often than they get it right with the draft positioning. It's just, to me, it is fascinating. It is such a hard position, right? You think about the funnel of quarterbacks in football in this country and how many are playing at the high school level, how many play at the college level and NFL. And yet every year, there's really like 10 or 12 good quarterbacks in the NFL. The position is so difficult and they make so many mistakes despite all the resources put into it. Penix to me is a guy like you watch him and you think, well, I see one thing, but then all these NFL teams see something else. I must be wrong. But sometimes they're the ones that are wrong. The NFL's wrong, right? They were wrong on Patrick Mahomes.
Right in your backyard. I mean, Brock Purdy. Like the NFL said, that guy's the last player in the draft. And we know he's not, you know, but part of Brock Purdy's success is in the fact that he didn't have to be the most important player on his offense. And, you know, he can be the fifth or sixth best player on that offense and thrive because they've got, you know, an all-world left tackle and an MVP caliber tight end and a wide receiver who's a game changer and a running back who could be an MVP. And you've got all these great players around him. And, you know, years ago when you and I were working at the same paper, I got the assignment to go. Bill Walsh was with the 49ers and he was working as a consultant with the Niners. And they were mostly ignoring him. He was sharpening pencils in his office while, you know, they were out practicing and he was supposed to be giving input on the draft. And I went and sat with him for a couple of days and just picked his brain about the draft. And it was interesting at the time, Wilner, you had Rich Gannon, who was with the Raiders at the time, who was leading the AFC in passing. And Jeff Garcia was with the Niners leading the NFC. Gannon was not a high pick. I believe, you know, he was a Delaware guy who was, you know, holding a clipboard for years in the NFL. Garcia went undrafted, had to go to the CFL. Those were your two best quarterbacks in the AFC and the NFC that season. And Walsh said it didn't matter, like, who you pick. It's what you have around them. And if you're going to pick somebody high and you have a bad team with no offensive line and no weapons, I mean, nobody should be surprised that that quarterback has no success. And so I almost think it's a blessing for a guy like Bo Nix or Michael Penix if they are drafted last half of the first round into the second round. Maybe the team that picks them picks up an offensive tackle or a massive need around them before they're drafted.
Yeah, well, and that's certainly for Penix, having an offensive line in front of him, given his injury history, the fact he's not super mobile, that is going to be hugely important, no doubt about that. It will also be interesting to see how many Pac-12 guys get picked in the first round, right? It's the last draft with the Pac-12 as we know it, and I think it's going to end up being a really good draft for the conference, and there could be five or six guys picked in the first round, you know, going out on a high note, so to speak.
Yeah, I'm interested in a guy like Rome Odunze, right? Who, where does he end up? Where does he go? You've got the edge guy, Latu from UCLA. Huge upside. Looks like a Chase Young-type player. You know, every year, you know, we watch these Jackson Powers Johnson, the you know, who's going to probably be a guard or a center in the NFL. Oregon center, you know, he's a guy who could be in the first round. I think you're going to see a handful of players picked in the opening round, maybe five or six in the first round. It could be one of the best drafts ever for the Pac-12.
Yep. Would be really quite the twist to the end of the show here for the Pac-12.
I'm John Canzano. You can read me at johncanzano.com. He's John Wilner. Find him at pac12hotline.com. Make sure you're subscribed to this podcast. Tweet at him, at Wilner Hotline. Tweet at me, at John Canzano BFT. Tell me who goes first, Michael Penix Jr. or Bo Nix. What do you think?
Thanks very much for listening, everybody.